Accession number 27083, reel 74.
Now, the size of the hospital made it difficult to maintain a hierarchical order because of its smallness, I
think. It was too small, yes. And so you didn't get...
What was your total staff, approximately?
I can't answer that off the top of my head, I'm afraid. The figure's gone out of my mind. But it wasn't big enough to permit that under normal conditions. But there was another candidate for the post of the new matron. And that was from a ward sister who had been such for several years, not very many, I think, four or five. And she was interviewed. I had made it quite clear to the rest of the selection committee that whatever they might think or say, I was not going to have the deputy matron as the future matron. And I leant over backwards and gave her an hour's interview. Instead of the usual 40 minutes or so. And to my great delight, this other person, who I'd never met before, she filled the bill. And we mutually agreed, unanimously agreed, that she was the right one. And it had the extra advantage that she was drawn from within the hospital, which was a great incentive to the others. And she took over in due course from the matron death, which was all quite quick, and well before March the following year, for obvious reasons. And
you'd have been happy to keep the previous matron on, providing she had kept it private to just a few people that she was going in March.
To a very few, yes.
But she insisted on making public to her
department. She said, I've already told my staff that I'm going to tell them, etc., etc. So she brought it on herself.
Yes, yes.
And there it was. She left behind several very senior members of the nursing staff who had been with her over the long years she'd been there, for many of them at any rate, and who were, so to speak, her disciples. And who you could say that the new matron, younger, less experienced and so forth, was undercutting. And I know that the new one, Caroline Castles, who is still there, I'm glad to say, and doing a superb job, she had a very difficult time to begin with to, not so much to control things, because she was sufficiently with it, and had she knew what was right and what was wrong, and wouldn't stand any nonsense, but to do it in a manner which would not cause an actual rift, a personality clash between herself and some of the senior staff, most of whom in due course left as things moved on and they became replaced and so forth. Well, we had various problems to overcome. We were going to refurbish, which was rather necessary, the first two floors, I think it was, of the hospital three. It's more than three, but they were the ward floors. And the third one was judged not to be affordable. And I had to fight quite hard to say this is absolutely absurd, because hard on the heels of completing the refurbishment, you will find that it is financially possible to do the third one. And then we'll have to tear it all apart again. And there comes a time when you've got to effectively shut the hospital down, and then you lose custom, and need I go on. What about affordability? I said, well, we got some reserves. That's why we have reserves, so let's use them. And we did. And thank God we did. And we I mean, there are mega things that are required nowadays. We put in a scanner, and that costs $250,000 or something. But if you don't have these facilities, you're not up with a hunt, and others are, and down you go. You've got to keep up with the hunt. So that's been an eye-opener, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I was made an honorary vice president. I do go. It's now sort of, they've changed the nomenclature, and I'm a governor. And I go there to the governor's meetings, which are twice yearly. But I was chairman from 87 to 98. I'll quickly turn now to the any other two things that I think are worth mentioning. Three things, perhaps. The first is the Royal Navy Club of, and I've forgotten what the dates are. They're up on the mantelpiece here, but I won't bore you. It's well known. It's known as the Navy Club. It was not founded by, but it was attended by Nelson in his day. And traditionally, it's been chaired, been presided over, no, chairman, I think was the phrase they used, of an ex-First Sea Lord, or very senior officer. You do a three-year stint. You used to have, I think it was six meetings a year, and then it came down to four, and I forget what it's running at now because I no longer go very often. To qualify for membership, you used to have to be an executive officer of commander's rank. So the paymasters and the engineers and the doctors and so forth were not eligible. I think now that still applies. They have kept their numbers up. It is a straightforward dining club. They appoint a president for the dining, each of the dining nights. The chairman of the club takes the presidency on the annual occasion when they dine the Admiralty Board. It's a very good thing, and it's great fun. And I took this on, I can't remember the precise dates, but I did the usual 3 years and was delighted to do it. I quickly found that, and by this time, of course, I was out of office, I quickly found that there were a small number of very senior, much older, retired naval officers, probably flag officers. And they tended to sort of disparage the Navy of the day. Don't blow like it used, sort of touch. And I developed a standard riposte to this, because a lot of these guys I hadn't personally served under and didn't know. One or two I didn't awfully like either. And I wasn't going to stand the Navy being run down by them. So I made a point of making sure that the secretary invariably introduced me to these creatures before we sat down at table. And immediately following his introduction, a fairly standard reaction from any individual would be, Navy is not what it used to be, is it? And I developed my return salvo, which ran something like, no, sir, because they loved being called sir. In fact, not one of them was an admiral of the fleet, was neither here nor there. No, sir. And thank God for it. Oh, ah, ah. And then we've got one or two reactions. They'd either stump off, muttering, damned young puppies, sort of thing, and you couldn't do anything about that lot. And that very seldom happened. Or else you explained that unless the Navy had moved, and moved with the times, it wouldn't be worth calling a Navy, and it certainly wouldn't be the effective thing that it was that day. And they took that. It's quite interesting.
And these are very old officers in their mid-late 80s, or...?
Not necessarily as old as that, but they were a good deal older than me.
So, I'm sorry, Sir Henry, just remind me of the three-year stint from when to when.
I can't remember that offhand, I'm afraid.
So it would be fairly
but it was
soon
in the...
Fairly soon after
It was in the 80s, the late 80s, I think it was. I was given the freedom of various things, which is very nice of them. The Worshipful Company of Shipwrights had made me an honorary freeman during my time as First Sea Lord, which was virtually standard practice with any First Sea Lord during his time. When I pulled out of active service, I found that I had so many other things to do that I couldn't go to the shipwrights' dinners. And so I thought it was wrong for me to continue to be an honorary freeman, which otherwise they would have been happy with. And so I said, I'd like to become a paid-up liveryman, and that was that. And that was when I found I couldn't go. And so I handed in my cards to be told that I remained an honorary freeman, and I still am. But I don't actually go there. I was made a freeman of the City of London in 82, and that was a nice little ceremony in Guildhall at lunchtime. And my wife came up with me, and they did it very nicely. The other thing was, I think they, on the great coloured hand-painted scroll that show these things, they gave me a KBE instead of a KCB, and I thought it was a bit cheap to challenge the butt, so I didn't react to that. What meant very much more to me was that the Merchant Tailors made me an honorary freeman in 83. And I'd been there as a guest several times, and I'm still an honorary freeman there, and I go regularly to one dinner a year. I have a number of friends there. It's a marvelous company. It's one of the smaller ones. It is the... It's... in the top flight, and you may know that it vies with the Skinners for pride of place. And there was an argument, I don't know how it initially arose, but way, way back, a fierce argument arose as to who should be number six and who should be number seven in the pecking order within the City Livery Companies. And the mayor of the day resolved this by, his name was Bilston, and it was known as the Bilston Award. And he said, right, in future, this year the Merchant Tailors will be six and the Skinners seven, and next year the Skinners will be six and the Merchant Tailors seven. Which gave rise to the saying, being at sixes and sevens. It is an interesting thing. But the Merchant Tailors are a particularly nice lot, young and old. Some of them are falling off the perch, sadly, now. And I go there. I used to take my wife, but after she died, quite quickly they latched onto this. And I take my oldest daughter in her place, which is extremely nice of them. They're a very friendly lot. And, of course, these are not just dining clubs. They do an enormous amount of good work. Merchant Taylors run two schools, one outside Liverpool and one at Northwood, and a whole lot of other things, too. They do an immense amount. And this, I think, is not generally realized by the man in the street. It's very fine. Then the only other thing, and it's 5 minutes to four, so I'm running to town. The only other thing, just to round it off, is that in 94, I was made patron of the Hampshire British Legion. Not a very exacting job, but you go to various functions, you attend the annual conference, you meet a cross-section of very good people, and one or two not so good, but that's the same in any community, and I still am that. And there, I think, we'll draw stumps. And when we resume, I will tell you the sad circumstances of when my wife died in 91.
Well, Sir Henry, thank you for that. Thank you also for this extraordinary contribution so far, which is by far the most detailed, not only the most detailed by far that I have had the privilege to listen to, but I think will be one of the most detailed which the museum has on its in its archive. So I look forward to our final meeting, which I think we know is next week. I've really got one or two questions for you.
Yes.
Which you can look forward to. And off the tape, we'll briefly discuss the sort of thing that I'd like to cover next week. And so we'll finish next week. But for the time being, thank you very, very, very much indeed.
Right. Thank you.
Sir Henry, thank you very much for continuing with your contribution to the IWM Sound Archive for what might prove to be our last conversation together. Can I open the batting by asking you something about yourself? I know that you might regard the fact that you've been speaking about yourself anyway for the last seven or eight sessions, but you did, in the context of the Falklands, describe yourself as a bit gung-ho, and then off the tape at the end of our last session, you described yourself as a bit of a rebel. And I wondered if you could expand on certainly the latter point. I think we've covered the first point, but the latter point, in the context of being a bit of a rebel within a highly disciplined service within which you served with distinction for 45 years.
Right, I'll do my best. I was using shorthand in both contexts, really, the gung-ho-ness. And the gung-ho-ness, it's not a phrase I also care for. And I usually, if I use the term at all, I use it mainly as a term of disparagement about other people, that Santo is so gung-ho and he doesn't know whether it's Christmas or Easter, and so on. I don't think I was gung-ho in that context, but I was determined at, and you mentioned the time of the Falklands and the run-up to it, I was determined to go all out to try and stimulate the politicians of the day into taking action and then holding to that action. And as I think I repetitively said, my constant and recurring anxiety was that political will, which soared to something of a crescendo initially, would degenerate, would deteriorate equally quickly, and then there'd be a lot of pussyfooting and the whole thing would be called off. And then we'd, as I described it, be living in a different country. On the rebel side, I suppose it was just part of my nature not to take everything for granted. And what I was told by, in my young days, by elders and betters, in my older days, probably by politicians, when I was told that so-and-so and so-and-so, and I must remember that, blah, 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 and if I found it unconvincing, I would not respond in accordance with the stated wish. I don't think there was anything very, very serious about it. But if, and of course, there's no better judge of the professionalism of, say, someone in command than what his subordinates feel about him. If their general reaction is, oh, not a bad chap, but an awful blowhard, or okay, I suppose, but when it comes down to some professional solution to a problem, he hasn't a clue, this is pretty damning stuff. And I didn't hesitate to feel those things about my then elders and betters, where they behaved accordingly. And I have, I think, mentioned several instances where they fell into that category. So I think that's probably enough about being a rebel. I suppose you can generalize and say you can divide the world into two categories, regardless of what your occupation is, yes men and no men. And I was inclined to be a no man, because I had seen so many examples of sycophancy and people saying, yes, sir, no, sir, three bags, four, sir, which really sort of caused my gorge to heave. I simply couldn't tolerate it. And didn't, I like to hope, ever behave like that myself, which got me into trouble from time to time for saying too much too soon or too loud. Could I perhaps end, because I think that's enough about me, and I'd like to end this side of the story with two tributes, of which the first is to my late wife. It was, I suppose, in the middle of January or so of 1991, when our splendid local GP, who had for long years been a good family friend, and who Mary had consulted because she'd had rather recurrent bouts of indigestion, which she didn't understand and upset her a bit, understandably. He'd taken some tests. And I remember it was at lunchtime one day, next door in my old house, and he dropped in on us, and we sat him down and tried to persuade him to have a glass of sherry, but he wouldn't. And he very gently and firmly and kindly told my wife that she had incurable cancer and 5 months to live. And this, of course, was absolutely earth-shattering. That afternoon, that very afternoon, we were due to go up to London, and I was supposed to open some art exhibition from an English marine artist who spent half his time in this country and half his time in the United States. And he painted that nice picture of the old Iron Duke, Jellicoe's flagship, at Customs House in Malta, which Mary spotted. I was supposed to open this exhibition up in London. Well, the doctor left. We had a rather silent and meditative lunch, and thought, well, we did say we'd go and have tea with so-and-so, and we did say we'd open this exhibition. We might as well complete the contract. It'll keep our mind off other things. And we did that, and I won't go on about it. And the next move was that Mary had to have a biopsy, which did nothing but confirm the worst, that it had spread and that it was inoperable and there was no hope. And the one after that was that we got her into hospital and they did some operation, in no way attempting a cure, which was not attemptable, but to make life for her remaining time a bit less uncomfortable. This was all internal stuff. On completion of which, we booked in at very short notice. We just wanted to get away and sort ourselves out, which wasn't easy. And we booked into a tiny little hotel in North Devon called Tower Steps. It's still going, I think, in deep country, miles from anywhere. And we spent a fortnight there. And various members of the family came, sometimes spent a night, sometimes they just came for a meal or whatever, and because it was the back and beyond, they probably spent a night and so on. And my youngest daughter, who was then very horsey, brought her horse down in a horse box and so forth. And I took my rod and fished the river, which didn't have any fish. And in any case, my mind was not really on fishing, but was on other things. And it was very much on other things, to the extent that while we were there, and this I think was a straight result of stress, I developed a heart complaint and felt rather unwell for a couple of days and so forth. So that was a further problem. Mary by then was, she was sort of recovering from her operation. And was taking things fairly gently, and she rested in the afternoon and that sort of thing. And then we returned home to await the inevitable back here, next door. And in due course the time came when she couldn't really leave her bed, and we moved her bed down into the drawing room so that she could look out of the French window and see the ducks as they came up to tap on the window panes demanding their breakfast or their supper.
It would now be springtime, I suppose.
It was now, yes, late spring. And from then on, it was all downhill, I'm afraid. And these things seldom come singly, I suppose. One of the earlier things was we had a slightly elderly, but not all that old, delightful golden retriever bitch, and she fell into the little river at the foot of the garden, and nobody noticed, and she tried to scramble out, but she couldn't get up the bank, and she must have been in there for about 4 hours or so, and was eventually discovered and brought in, and we tucked her up next to the auger in the kitchen. But she had advanced hypothermia and had lost control of all her activities and so forth, so she had to be put down. And then the cat, the family cat, stopped eating, and she had to be put down. And by this time, of course, Mary, and I'm talking now of late May, early June, 91, Mary was obviously degenerating steadily. And it got to the point, I'd moved my bed down and put it alongside hers in the drawing room, but it got to the point when I hardly dared go to sleep because I was anxious that she shouldn't slip away while I myself was asleep. And for the last two or three nights or so, I didn't use my bed. I flaked out on the sofa, dressed, which was much more uncomfortable, and therefore I was unlikely to sleep too deeply and so forth. But I was getting fairly short of sleep. And then late one evening, and the doctor came, and I think he was a shrewd man, and he knew that the time had come. And it obviously had come. And I sat by her bedside, and I held her hand. And then finally the soft brown eyes opened for the last time. And that was it. And I was absolutely shattered, of course. And I remember by this time my daughter and her husband had rallied round, so they were doing the cooking and so forth. And we had a miserable supper. And that's enough. That was the end of my wife, who had been my devoted companion, and she was a super girl for whatever it was, 34 years. Well, just to complete that saga of unhappiness, the following year, my brother, who I have mentioned earlier on, elder brother,